Blog Talk Radio.
Last month, we started talking about the abundance pyramid as a model for maximizing the potential of every person on Earth. Today, we take a deeper look at the pyramid's base: clean drinking water, nutritious food, and shelter.
Many people sense that something is wrong, like a dull ache just below the surface. The American dream doesn't seem to be working anymore. Not everyone gets a house with a white picket fence, a chicken in every pot, and more successful children. Are you working hard but can't make ends meet, even with two incomes? Do you see the steady rise in homelessness, hunger, and stagnation despite the official statistics? Has chasing the American dream led to piles of debt and a rat race for jobs without meaning? Enough of this one-size-fits-all vision of happiness. The traditional worldviews simply don't have the frame of reference that can describe, much less understand, what's going on today. Those old frames of reference worked well enough for people old enough to remember World War II, but those default visions just don't cut it anymore. And traditional institutions like the media, schools, and government don't have anything better to offer either. It's time to jump to a new vision, a new American dream, because we are in a new era, a new age. The shift requires us to reimagine the way we work, play, grow, and interact with our surroundings. I call it the new economy. Instead of collecting more things, people will focus on awakening their full potential. That includes helping others and making sure that having enough is a sustainable lifestyle. Our vision has four pillars: health, sustainability, peace, and abundance. We make progress by focusing on projects that build up each pillar for a season: the summer of peace, the autumn of abundance, and so on. Everything seems to be in chaos because we are in the transition, several years into a multi-year shift, and the old systems are being overwhelmed. This show not only explores the new era and the transition, we engage with the solutionary doers and thinkers who are creating this next stage for the human race. Most important, we sketch out the blueprint for joining and thriving in the new economy. Don't get caught up in the drumbeat of tragedy that you hear in today's mass media. Jump on board and help us build the next level.
When you talk to the experts about the new technology to provide clean drinking water for the developing world, they'll tell you that with 4 billion people making less than $2 a day, there's no viable business model, no economic model, and no way to finance development costs. But the 25 poorest countries already spend 20% of the GDP on water. This 20%, about 30 cents, ain't much. But do the math again. 4 billion people spending 30 cents a day is 1.2 billion market, or is a 1.2 billion market every day. That's $400 billion a year. I can't think of too many companies in the world that have a $400 billion in sales a year. And you don't have to do a market study to find out whether that there's a need. It's water. There's a need. That quote came from mega inventor Dean Kamen. Hey, everybody. Glad to have you along. I want to start tonight by introducing our brand new host, Corinne Wilder. And she's a huge advocate of the environment and of sustainability. And she understands that eco-responsible business practices, program management, and analytic business development. I met her last weekend at a festival that we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks called Voice and Exit. So I want to say welcome to fellow Exeter, Corinne Wilder.
Hi, Cliff. How are you?
I'm great. So tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Okay. Well, I guess I could start off with my current situation, or I say situation. It's probably one of the best things that's happened to me in my life. I currently work for a company called Fluence Bioengineering. We sell, manufacture, and promote LED lighting fixtures for the horticulture industry. So not only do we manufacture these solutions, we also provide services for consultation for new hydroponic facilities as well. So anything that's using and producing food, basically, for our nations today. So luckily, I get to do management of sales operations and consultations with current customers right now, and we're going out and we're hunting new ones as well. But that's a little bit of what I do, and I'll explain more about the LED practices and what we actually accomplish for food, be it basil, be it tomatoes, be it broccoli, carrots, anything that you're producing. There's also the medicinal qualities that come through some other products that we we help with customers today. So besides that, I grew up in a state park in East Texas. When I say a state park, I literally mean I grew up in a park that was about 60,000 acres, and it had a lake with a power plant on it. It was a coal-burning power plant. But this power plant kept the lake warm throughout the year, so I was able to basically swim in this lake, kayak, had basically anybody's perfect dream of a childhood. That taught me through those practices and through growing up there just a deep appreciation for water, for land, for animals, for life in general. I just got to see plants and animals interact in ecosystems on a day-to-day basis that I think gave me a real appreciation and understanding for biology, just biology in general, the plant flow, the process of nature, water, and how it flows and ebbs throughout any and every system in life. So that gave me a huge appreciation for everything that I'm working on today. I'm trying to say this correctly, but literally everything that I'm working on today. I got my bachelor's degree in ecology and marine biology from Texas A&M down in Corpus Christi. I studied oysters. I studied aquaculture. I studied estuarine environments and the interactions within those. So just the ebb and flow of fresh water meeting salt water and the very dense and rich environment it creates. And that just drove my appreciation to aquaculture even more. I did move to Nashville, Tennessee a little bit later and started working for Panasonic in their LED lighting division, which was kind of not in the plan. It's when 2007 hit and the market crashed and I needed to go make money where I could when I had just graduated college. So I started working there, but that gave me a deep passion for LED lighting as well and how much it can do for energy savings in the environment through that ecological impact, really, from energy savings. So basically, it leads me to where I am today. I left Panasonic. I work for Fluence Bioengineering, and I'm very happy to be on this show and co-hosting with Cliff.
Fantastic. You know, we just met last weekend, and I think that the reason I asked you was because I thought you asked, I can't remember which talk it was, but I thought you asked a particularly good question. And afterwards, I don't know if you remember, but I specifically asked you, are you more influenced by abundance or by sustainability? And you answered sustainability, and you didn't know it at the
really quickly.
You didn't know it at the time, but I had been thinking that I needed a yin-yang relationship for a co-host. And by that, it's because I'm passionate about abundance, as you'll probably hear when I talk tonight. And sustainability is critical to abundance, but they're opposite sides of the coin. And that's why I asked you to host with us.
Brilliant.
So, hey, plus, I had no idea about your marine biology background. That's we'll take that conversation offline.
Well, we only had so much time to catch up at the show.
Exactly. So, before we get started with the main topic, I want to take a little side detour about the whole idea of freedom from fear. You know, most people are absolutely terrified of change, and it's built, if you will, it's built into our DNA. By that, you know, people through most of human existence, what worked for long periods of time. And so they didn't want to change because they knew that worked. And trying something different, particularly in the early parts of our history, could prove fatal. So it's certainly built into our DNA, and that's why a fear of change is fundamental. The catch is that we're in a world today where change is a given. And in fact, I remember a couple of years ago having a conversation at work where I said, you know, I've dealt with more change in the last week than Neanderthal man did in a lifetime. And no one disagreed with me. There's also the second factor that people don't believe that it's even possible to change simply because they lack the skills to do it. I read a story recently about a missionary who went to work in the very, very poor parts of Appalachia in the United States, and she wanted to build a church. Well, in this little town, and it was very isolated, the people never went to the bigger city or even the bigger town. They pretty much never left this little village. The stonemasons had all died off. There had been no one for a couple, three generations that knew how to build anything out of stone, because they'd build their houses out of wood, you know, just abundant lumber in the Appalachian Mountains. And so when she said, well, let's build a stone church, no one in the town believed it could be done. So, you know, fear of change is also frequently a lack of skills or a lack of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So we also have the case of people wanting to, I call it the nostalgia craze. And nostalgia has always been there. I grew up in the 1970s, where the biggest TV show was a show called Happy Days, which was nostalgia about how wonderful things were in the 50s. So I think much of the latest political campaign have been about making America great again. And we tend to believe that, you know, the past is so much rosier because it's pretty normal of human beings to forget the bad stuff and wax nostalgic about what used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But things have changed so much that we can't stuff that genie back into the bottle. You know, and besides that, if you look at the way things actually were in the industrial age, it was based on Darwinian struggle, that things were random and only the strongest survived. There was competition and there was scarcity for all sorts of resources. And that whole idea, it's falling apart in today's world. There really is plenty if we know how to look for it. And technology has really helped. In fact, when we talk a lot about the food segment, we'll talk about how technology has made things better and how changing this. And you certainly understand how the technology of LED lights have made growing more efficient, just as one simple, one very small example. The way to overcome fear is effectively to let go. You just got to embrace the new and let and the new principles and let cooperation and learn to cooperate with your with other people and just build a community relationship, and this fear of change will fade away.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. If I may comment real quick, one of the basic rules of biology is that everything must maintain an equilibrium. So if you continue to push and push and try to extract more and more from the current resources that we have, we're going to fall out of a state of equilibrium. We already have. Like, we're already creating global climate change. I mean, you were talking about scarcity and competition before. I just, you know, I'll be completely honest about this. I'm not pulling this out of my brain. I did just Google it, which is another form of how we're changing and that we're becoming more technologically advanced. But I just Googled how much do grocery stores throw away every year, because it's something I've always questioned. And it's an estimated $20 billion worth of food in U.S., just U.S. supermarkets are thrown away. And that's just supermarkets. I'm looking at another study that shows that 40% of U.S. food is thrown away across all of our industries, be it supermarkets and convenience stores and restaurants. It's appalling to me. It's appalling. But I'll let you continue. I just wanted to throw that segment in there.
I just wanted to just respond with a piece of hope to exactly what you're talking about. I didn't participate in this directly, but it's a story I heard as a recruitment tool for this for SCORE, which is the Service Corps of Retired Executives, where a fellow who had been in the retired from the supply chain business was doing a little volunteer work in a food bank. And the food bank was always short of food, and he saw the exact problem that you talked about grocery stores throwing away food. And so he connected the two and figured out how to take food from grocery stores that they were going to throw out, but it was still edible, but it had reached it was still safe, but it had reached expiration date where you wouldn't have the same freshness wasn't there, the color wasn't there, and was able to put it into food mm-hmm. banks to where people who were starving could have food.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, that's a case of how community and cooperation can overcome some of these problems. And you touched on Google, and we will have a segment later on about the tools of abundance and exponential growth, the exponential growth in information technology and how it touches the real world and how that can really help things. The last thought I had on fear before we move on to the main topic is that shamans from most traditions tell us that some variation of we are not what we have been told we are, and you're more than you have imagined. So if you can imagine growing up with these possibilities, being taught these possibilities instead of fear, instead of separation, how much better would your life be? You know, I heard you talk about growing up in a very nice rural environment, and you learned to love the land. So, and instead of being worried about it going away, you are doing what you need to do to make sure that other people can do it.
Absolutely. I want to empower people to do it. I want to make sure that they understand the rich environment that they could be missing if they haven't checked into it or looked into it. It's amazing.
That's true. Well, our main topic for tonight, though, is abundance. And just to review, abundance is the idea that everyone on the planet has a life where basic needs are met and everyone has the possibility to reach their full potential. In the introduction we did about a month ago, we described the eight key elements of abundance and how they can be organized into a pyramid with three layers. There's the tonight we're going to focus on the bottom layer, and that consists of the elements that are required for human survival. Before we go on, I really need to acknowledge that I was turned on to the whole idea of abundance by a book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, by my hero, Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler. And just as an aside, the whole reason I found out about Voice and Exit in the first place was in a conversation with a volunteer coordinator at another conference who told me that Stephen Kotler had spoken at Voice and Exit the year before I found out about it. So that's okay.
Oh, wow. That's so funny, because the reason I wanted to go to Voice and Exit, Cliff, is because I heard that John Mackey spoke last year. And John Mackey is the CEO and founder of Whole Foods. So that's really interesting. Can't say enough about Voice and Exit. It's such a fantastic conference.
Not to make you jealous, but I worked as a volunteer last year. And because of the fact that I was a volunteer, I got 15 minutes of one-on-one FaceTime with John Mackey after he spoke.
Oh, that completely makes me jealous. Now, I can't believe I didn't tell you that before. Wow.
So, anyway, people think that abundance just can't happen. Of course, the fear that we talked about earlier is really the prime blocker. But when we talk about abundance, there's really three false assumptions that keep the fear alive. First is the mistaken belief that the hole of how bad things are is just too deep to climb out of. And if you really look at the statistics, that's not true. The second assumption is it's called cognitive bias. And everyone has it. It's the way that the brain deals with decision making with incomplete information or time constraints or unreliable information. We build a model of the way we believe the world works, and it's generally subconscious. And we use that model as a shortcut. And there's a fancy word for it, heuristics, which is really just rules of thumb, to make decisions, especially when we have to make snap decisions. What it tends to do is make us ignore data that doesn't fit our model, just pretend it doesn't exist. You can see, you could almost call it the moaning pessimism, abundance world. But you can see it, you saw it very, very clearly in the most recent political campaign. It's real easy to see the cognitive bias of the other side. And I make a point of trying to keep an even balance of liberal and conservative friends. And I followed their Facebook posts. And to be perfectly honest, both sides had cognitive bias. A lot of it having to do with the fact that they just had to promote their candidate. And, once they've made their choice, they'll overlook the shortcomings of their person and magnify the shortcomings of the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the duality of nature, honestly. It's always a black and white. My guy's right, your girl's wrong, your girl's right, my guy's wrong. It's always going to be a right or wrong question, which is kind of frustrating. I wish there was more gray area in between the two, but you're absolutely right.
Well, I catch myself having a cognitive bias all the time. And I have to – actually, the best solution for it is to train yourself to go, oh, I'm showing cognitive bias, and even if you're trying to pay attention, you miss it, because I know quite frequently somebody will be saying something and they'll be telling a story And then there's something that they'll spout off a fact that I know is not true. I tend to shut down for the next 5 minutes while I chew over the fact that that fact isn't true. And I may miss a whole long train of thought or a chain of argument. And sometimes if it's a fairly complicated conversation, I never get back. My brain is so derailed that I never get back in the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's normal. And excuse me, everybody has it. You just have to fight against it. The last
I'm glad
of those,
you admitted that because I do it too. I'm glad you admitted that.
Everybody does. The last of the assumptions is based on the way our brain is wired. We as humans are designed to think locally and in a linear fashion. You know, 1, 2, 3. That's the way our brain works. But the world is global, obviously, by definition. And things in the world tend to happen at exponential rates. I don't think I've ever on the show really talked much about exponential rate growth, but you know that's where you go 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Things start out very, very slowly, but once they get, if they're constantly doubling over a set period of time, things will grow really, really fast after a while. But our brains are not really wired for that. And what it tends to cause is what I like to call the local optimist. That also has to do with the fact that locally you can have some control over the things in your immediate environment. But global pessimism, you know, we have global warming and there's nothing I can do about it. There's a limit to the amount of what we can get our heads around. And it tends to be, actually it's been defined as Dunbar's number. This weekend I was really glad to hear that at least one, maybe two of the speakers discussed Dunbar's number, which happens to be 150. It's also saying that you can only really get to know 150 people. It doesn't matter how many thousands of people you have in your Twitter feed or how big your fan base is. There's really only 150 people in your world. Because that's all you can really get to know. That's kind of the setup of why people tend to think abundance can't happen. And hopefully we've kind of debunked that idea. But just a review of the upper layers of the abundance pyramid, and we'll get to those in a lot of detail in a future show, probably in about a month. The top two layer consists of the two blocks of health and freedom. And the middle layer are the three blocks of energy, education, and information technology. And of course, the bottom layers we're going to talk about are water, food, and shelter. So the bottom layer is what's required for survival. The middle layer enables both specialization and our ability to operate in a community and as opposed to individuals. And also to thrive as a community. And the top layer is what opens up a world of possibilities, where at the beginning of the show I said that abundance is everyone's basic needs are taken care of and they can at least have an opportunity to reach their fullest potential. Those top two layers are what really opens up those opportunities. So now that we've spent about half the time on the show, we're finally getting to the main topics: water, food, and shelter. And I'm going to start on water with some facts. The Earth is a water planet, and 3/4 of the Earth is covered in water, but about 97% of that is salt water. So of the 3% remaining that's fresh water, nearly 70% of it is locked up in glaciers and the ice caps, the polar ice caps, and about 30% of it is groundwater. When I said that, it's 69% that's in the glaciers and the ice caps. That leaves only 1% of the Earth's water that's usable for drinking water, and that's before we start polluting it. You add to the fact that almost everything contains water or the need in, or the need to use water in its production process, not just food. It takes 35 gallons of water to make a microchip. It just producing energy takes about 20% all the non-food related consumption of water. It was once said that to raise a steer takes enough water to float a battleship. And it takes 400, and there's also an estimation that 443 million school days a year are lost because of waterborne disease. But there's hope. Technology, as a person who makes their living in technology, and I think you do too, we like the idea of technology, and that's just a fancy word that says we've made better tools. Well, the technology allows people to specialize. Specialization means that people have to cooperate, because the shoemaker has to trade shoes with the person who grows the food, and the person who grows the food has to trade with the person who trains the horses, and so forth. So specialization means you can't be in the old phrase, no person is an island. It creates cooperation. And of course, that also leads us to greater complexity. And to make it all work, we form communities, and that takes us right back around to the next round of technology. So the hope is that virtuous cycle can make things better. As an example of a place where technology can help with water, Peter Williams thinks that about 30 to 50% of the U.S. water consumption is lost out leaky pipes. And this way, and we have a technology called sensors and artificial intelligence and the Internet of Things that should be able to fix that situation. Also, the most of the pollution is human sanitation. Not only, I could name project after project. There's several of turning wastewater into a potential energy source. That's actually a prize. That's a good working model of a toilet that can compost and generate energy is being funded. Actually, several teams are being funded by the Gates Foundation right now to try to develop that. So while you go to the bathroom, you can charge your cell phone. None of that pollution gets into the water supply and pollutes the water. So there's some hope here. And generally speaking, when we talk about abundance and fixing these problems, there is no one silver bullet solution. There's a whole bunch of little solutions that together make things better. And they feed each on other and then grow exponentially. Do you have any water thoughts before we moved on to food?
I mean, I know that I've heard that agriculture uses somewhere between 40 to 43% of our entire water use just going to farming, whether that be cattle farming, agriculture, as far as horticulture. You even have to include things like ornamentals, be it orchids. Orchids take up a lot of water. That's one of the reasons they're so hard to grow. And you think, well, gosh, it's just a drop in the bucket, but I mean, these plants, every single thing that uses water to grow needs an abundant amount. Like, you're talking about abundance, but we need to realize where our scarcity comes in as well. You know, we've been going through this so-called, like, water scarcity crisis here in the U.S. for a while, and I say so-called, not to put it in, doubtful terms, but California, Texas, I mean, even where I was in Tennessee, and indefinitely here in Texas, they will mandate a restriction of water use because we are going through and have been going through a drought phase for a while. California is a major example. They plan to cut their use by 25%, and they won't allow people to water their yards anymore, especially in the Southwest. But that's where I think selecting the right plant comes into play. There's a lot of, I talked to you about my interest in green roots, and one of the fun things is you really have to tailor the plants that go on your green roots to a particular area that you're in. You can't use a succulent up in the Pacific Northwest. It needs to be in more of a drought-stricken area like California. So you can use these succulents that require a little less water to produce a beautiful green roof, whereas people usually think, oh, I want, these lush grasses and these beautiful, like, terrarium plants. You just need to be – one thing I think I just want to stress through my whole tenure here on the show is just being realistic and looking at the facts and exploring the science behind things. That's why I think it's important to not just go off of conjecture, is to actually look up and research the facts and see where things are moving. So I'm sorry, I went into a bit of a rant there, but water use is extremely important, and we do need to be very careful because we are going to run into much more of a water demand stipulations as we move forward within the next few years because of all of the, A, the climate change is happening, and B, the population is increasing, and that's going to put a greater demand on our food supply infrastructure. So just something to not see. This is about hope. This is about change. But we need to marry that hope and change with facts to understand where we are so we can know how to move forward.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Designing the correct solution always starts with a good set of facts. I absolutely agree with that. So the second block in the abundance, in the base of the abundance pyramid, is food. Now, it's been said that feeding the hungry is the world's oldest charity. And as far back as there's writing, there's discussion of feeding the hungry. So I think Jesus even said the poor will always be among us. So, that is not – that's something that – solving solving world hunger is something that we'll probably be working on several generations after both of us are gone. But we're still going to make it – we're going to do our best to make it better in the now. But having said the now, I want to next talk about where our mentality about food shortages came from. There was an economist named Malthus in the 19th century that published a paper called The Limits to Growth, and he pretty much said that by the turn of the 20th century, the whole world was going to starve to death because of population growth. What he left out was the fact that am I still on?
I hear you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All of a sudden, my mic went dead. It sounded like it went dead. I was afraid I got disconnected. But obviously, the whole world didn't starve to death in 1900 because technology advanced to make farming practices more efficient. Well, that became entered the age of the industrial age of brute force farming. And that increased crop yields on the land. And then we industrialized the distribution system. And finally, we industrialized the food itself, which probably isn't such a good thing, highly processed foods. But up to now, that's worked fairly well. And in fact, technology hasn't stopped. Technology hasn't stopped. It certainly made it better. Mm-hmm. We currently farm 38% of the land. If we were applying 1961 technology, which is I was just getting potty trained in 1961. If we applied that technology, it would require 92% of the land to reach today's production levels of food. And now, when I say that, that is total farming, not just food production. So I should need to correct that. But still, we've gotten that much more efficient. Of course, we are hitting our limits. what is it? It takes 10 calories of oil now to produce a calorie of food. And of course, the methods, the brute force methods I've just been describing up to now, do damage to the soil and the water and all the ecosystems. The runoff from fertilizers, for example, have caused the fishing to be poor, and that's why we have to import fish. So the next technological round of technological improvement has got to be in the green space. In other words, exactly the area that you're an expert in. And that's where the next technological revolution in farming needs to come from, and probably is coming from. Bringing a lot of what I hear are things like permaculture, which is learning how to grow food with less water, doing away with ornamental yards, which you've already mentioned, things like, and all sorts of things like vertical farming. You've already mentioned rooftop farming. And before I let you go on about it, I had one last point to make on this topic, which was about if we can end starvation, it will actually help with world population. The reason I say that is because in nations where there's a high infant mortality rate, the average family has about 8 children, and that's probably a low number. But if you take that same situation or that same family and make them secure in the fact that their family is going to be fed and they're not going to die of starvation or disease or waterborne illnesses, and very quickly the average family size drops to below 2 children. So in many ways, a clean drinking fountain is the best birth control we could possibly provide to the starving world. So that's something of a tangent, but I know you wanted to talk about some of the up and coming technologies in food production.
Yeah, and I'll say my quote unquote expertise lies more in the horticulture area, because that's what I've been studying specifically correlated to my job. But I'm glad you didn't ask me specifically to talk about fish, because I could go on and on and on about how we are depleting our fish stocks, and it's absolutely rampant, disgusting fishing practices that we have that are depleting the stocks up in the Pacific Northwest, halibut, cobia, mullet, all sorts of different fish that we have. And then the bluefin tuna which is one of the most prized fish in the ocean right now. Definitely, I'm sure if you've had sushi at any point in your life, you recognize bluefin tuna. There was one tuna, I think, that sold in the Japanese market for about $85 million for one tuna. Now, that's rampantly disgusting, but case in point, it's one of those things that there's so much waste that denotes the reason behind why that fish sold for so high, so expensive of a price. It's absolutely ridiculous, but because there's things that have to, there's forces at play with the way that we treat our produce and our fish stocks and our meats, like I said, with the grocery store, with throwing away 40% of the produce, that if we're going to start living sustainably and if we're going to start practicing more of a responsible way and a path towards moving forward and towards treating our environment, then we're really going to have to pay attention to our current processes and start breaking these molds that we've been entrenched in since the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when a lot of this became more agriculturally like a mass production line, just like a factory, like you're building a car. You can't treat nature the same way. So it's I love the premise behind permaculture, because what it is, it's working with rather than against nature. You're trying to kind of go back to that. You've heard this farm-to-table movement for the last 5+ years, I think. And that's really stemming from people recognizing these, celebrity chefs that have kind of really started the movement to recognize that food is more delicious when you produce it sustainably. It's more delicious when you take care of it and it's not run through a factory line. You know, you hear all these stories about chemical washes on chickens and the meat that goes through, dunking it in bleach before it hits the production line just to make sure it doesn't contain it, traces of salmonella. Why would you rather have that than a butcher that's gone to his farm and has brought the meat to market? Yeah, it may be 25% more in price than you're used to paying, but wouldn't you rather not put bleach in your body? It's a rhetorical question, but I'm just throwing it out there. So I kind of want to talk about how sustainability is really, you know, you can go to any website online or you can go to any blogger or look up the definition in the dictionary and the thesaurus, and it basically will say it's just the capacity to endure. And if abundance, like what you were saying, is basically meeting the basic needs of the human population, just meeting those needs, we need the capacity to endure along with that. So meeting those needs now and being able to meet them for future generations. We have such a mindset now with people is just to take. What can I take from the environment, from what's around me? And we, with no thought to like, well, is there going to be some left for tomorrow? Right now, we don't have to worry about that for the most part because we live in this wonderful country called America. As, you know, toiled and tumultuous as it's become lately with these elections and people wanting to strangle each other for the election. But we need to think about what's coming tomorrow. We've been in this land of abundance and almost this land of excess that we don't have to worry about tomorrow for the most part. A lot of other people in a lot of countries do, and a lot of the people below the poverty line here in the U.S. do need to worry about that, which is unfortunate. But, you know, if we're at 7.5 billion people now in the world, there's predictions that we're going to be around 9 billion people by 2050. So in order
I'm going to jump in here because we're running low on time. And the premise of the book Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, is that there's going to be 9 billion people by the year 2050. 35, and how are we going to deal with it? So that's the whole premise of the book. If we're going to do anything with shelter, I've got to jump on because I have a tape to run about ideas about alternative living ways of living. And this is from a TED Talk from Courtney Martin, and we're going to be dang near out of time when it's over. So I'm just going to play it, and we aren't even going to have time to discuss it. Sorry.
Okay.
Here goes.
I'm a journalist, so I like to look for the untold stories, the lives that quietly play out under the scream of headlines. I've also been going about the business of putting down roots, choosing a partner, making babies. So, for the last few years, I've been trying to understand what constitutes the 21st century good life, both because I'm fascinated by the moral and philosophical implications, but also because I'm in desperate need of answers myself. We live in tenuous times. In fact, for the first time in American history, the majority of parents do not think that their kids will be better off than they were. This is true of rich and poor, men and women. Now, some of you might hear this and feel sad. After all, America is deeply invested in this idea of economic transcendence, that every generation kind of leapfrogs the one before it, earning more, buying more, being more. We've exported this dream all over the world, so kids in Brazil and China and even Kenya inherit our insatiable expectation for more. But when I read this historic poll for the first time, it didn't actually make me feel sad. It felt like a provocation. Better off based on whose standards? All right, so is better off getting a big house with a white picket fence? Less of us are doing that. Nearly 5 million people lost their homes in the Great Recession, and even more of us sobered up about the lengths we were willing to go or be tricked into going in many predatory cases to hold that deed. Homeownership rates are at their lowest since 1995. Are those the best measurements of a country's greatness, of a life well lived? What I think makes America great is its spirit of reinvention. In the wake of the Great Recession, more and more Americans are redefining what better off really means. Turns out it has more to do with community and creativity than dollars and cents. Part of what I've learned in my research and reporting is that the art of living well is often practiced most masterfully by the most vulnerable. Now, if necessity is the mother of invention, I've come to believe that a recession can be the father of consciousness. It confronts us with profound questions, questions we might be too lazy or distracted to ask in times of relative comfort. How should we work? How should we live? All of us, whether we realize it or not, seek answers to these questions with our ancestors kind of whispering in our ears. So I ask these questions by way of a few generations of struggle. My parents made sure that I grew up on the kind of steady ground that allows one to question and risk and leap. And ironically, and probably sometimes to their frustration, it is their steadfast commitment to security that allows me to question its value, or at least its value as we've historically defined it in the 21st century. Now, how about the second question? How should we live? We should live like our immigrant ancestors. When they came to America, they often shared apartments, survival tactics, childcare, always knew how to fill one more belly, no matter how small the food available. But they were told that success meant leaving the village behind and pursuing that iconic symbol of the American dream, the white picket fence. And even today, you know, we see a white picket fence and we think success, self-possession. But when you strip away the sentimentality, what it really does is divides us. Many Americans are rejecting the white picket fence and the kind of highly privatized life that happened within it, and reclaiming village life, reclaiming interdependence instead. 50 million of us, for example, are living in intergenerational households. This number exploded with the Great Recession, but it turns out people actually like living this way. Two-thirds of those who are living with multiple generations under one roof say it's improved their relationships. Some people are choosing to share homes, not with family, but with other people who understand the health and economic benefits of daily community. Co-Abode, an online platform for single moms looking to share homes with other single moms, has 50,000 users. And people over 65 are especially prone to be looking for these alternative living arrangements. They understand that their quality of life depends on a mix of solitude and solidarity, which is really true of all of us when you think about it, young and old alike. For too long, we've pretended that happiness is a king in his castle, but all the research proves otherwise. It shows that the healthiest, happiest, and even safest in terms of both climate change disaster, in terms of crime, all of that are Americans who live lives intertwined with their neighbors. Now, I've experienced this firsthand. For the last few years, I've been living in a co-housing community. It's 1.5 acres of persimmon trees, you know, this prolific blackberry bush that snakes around a community garden, all smack dab, by the way, in the middle of urban Oakland. The 9 units are all built to be different sizes, different shapes, but they're meant to be as green as possible. So big, shiny black solar cells on our roof mean our electricity bill rarely exceeds more than $5 in a month. The 25 of us who live there are all different ages and political persuasions and professions, and we live in homes that have everything a typical home would have. But additionally, we share an industrial-sized kitchen and eating area where we have common meals twice a week. Now people, when I tell them I live like this, people often have one of two extreme reactions. Either they say, why doesn't everyone live like this? Or they say, that sounds totally horrifying. I would never want to do that. So let me reassure you, there is a sacred respect for privacy among us, but also a commitment to what we call radical hospitality. Not the kind advertised by the Four Seasons, but the kind that says that every single person is worthy of kindness. Full stop, end of sentence. The biggest surprise for me of living in a community like this: you share all the domestic labor, the repairing, the cooking, the weeding, but you also share the emotional labor. Rather than depending only on the idealized family unit to get all of your emotional needs met, you have 2 dozen other people that you can go to.
We're so low on time that I cut it, that I actually cut it. There's still another couple of minutes in this clip, but I wanted to start. I wanted to do 2 quick things before we called it a night. One is ask everyone to join our mailing list. You can do that by texting "jump to the next level." That's all one word, to 44222. It'll prompt you to enter your email address, and if you'll join, we will give you more information about tonight's topic, and we'll also keep you up to date about upcoming shows. Thanks for joining me tonight. It's been great.
It's great. I'm sorry I took so long and I didn't get into half of the things I wanted to say, but there's more time in the future.
Absolutely. So there's not going to be a show next week because it's Thanksgiving week, but the week of November 29th, we're going to review this festival that the two of us were just at called Voice and Exit. And it's subtitled "Criticized by Creating." And our special guest is going to be Max Borders, who was one of the founders. So I think both of us are really excited about that. And
yes.
And all I can say is good night. And sorry it's going to cut off in the middle of the closing sequence.
I'm so grateful you chose to spend this time with me. Remember that every one of us builds this new era one choice at a time. Start living now like it's already here. Commit a random act of kindness this week. Make healthy, sustainable choices. Choose peace. Choose abundance. Then celebrate your progress and passion. It is important to know that the future is in your hands. You create it through the choices you make in the now. See you next week.
So you're still on, right?
Oh, I still am. Sorry, I was on mute.
That's okay. It actually kicked us off of the air in the part of the closing that says, make healthy, sustainable choices. And nothing after that got heard. That's how close we were.
Oh, man. Oh, my God. I am so sorry. I didn't realize that last benediction was going to be like 10 minutes, or I would have cut it. I would have got to the point much sooner. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, it was the truth is that's an edit of a TED Talk about it was an 8-minute edit of a 17-minute TED Talk. But in the past, I'd always run it. I had run out of stuff to say after 30 or 35 minutes. And even the night I interviewed Giaconda, we ran out of stuff to say at about 45. So you and I talking are the first time that we've actually filled a whole show. And so I just made the assumption that, we're going to if we can make this thing stretch to 50 minutes, that's great. And I had to figure out, okay, what am I not going to say? No commercial, no Debt Hackers commercial. We definitely want to ask people to do the, to join the mailing list and at least get part of the benediction out.
That's too funny. While we were going through this, I was like, I wonder how much time you have to spend on each one of these. So maybe like next time we can put like end by X time frame or end by like 45 minutes, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes here, something like that. So
yeah.
I know when to shut up because I can keep, you saw, I can just keep going and going.
Did you ever get an email with the link? Well, you probably wouldn't have had the what's called the an online studio. See, I had a timer up in the corner running to tell me how much time was left.
Well, I didn't. I have the clock right in front of me, and I just didn't know how much time like the last few pieces were going to take.
Yeah. That one time recording. It was 8:22, and I think I cut it off after about six and a half minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the very ending is actually 47 seconds. So,
47 seconds.
Yeah, so we want to try to make this a 50 nut. Well, and let's see, the intro. Yeah, one of the emails I sent you had all the times, but I sent you like a machine gun of emails. So I didn't figure you got through them all. And I wouldn't have done that had it not been for the fact that I had yesterday off and I wanted to get all the prep work done that I possibly could because I was right that I was going to be slammed. Actually, I wasn't as slammed as I thought because I was supposed to do two presentations to one of the big bosses. And she had some sort of accident and is in the hospital.
Oh, no.
So, needless to say, her work consisted of canceling meetings over the last couple of days.
That sounds nice. I wish I could get sick and can't. I mean, not that I wish I was sick or wish I had what she did if she'd gone to the hospital. But, I could use a bit of a break. I was talking with a couple other people from Voice and Exit, and they last night I just like completely. I think I fell asleep at 9:30. I was so exhausted.
Yeah, well, I told Karen I was going to come back to the hotel by 10:30. I wasn't going to stay late at the party, but the good I think you liked the first band. Me not so much. So I didn't really like the music until about 10 o'clock. I was actually left. I told you were missing and you were MIA and I told Colleen that I'm gonna go home. And then, as
well,
I was
came back, I saw you later, right?
Well, that was at about midnight, and I was walking out, and the final singer, the headliner, and I don't know her name, came on, and she was good. I could hear outside she was good. So I walked back in, and about two rows in front of me, Max was dancing in front of the stage, and it was just so much fun. I finally dragged myself away about 1 o'clock.
Yeah. I think we stayed right after two. We basically shut it down. And then I ended up going out with Eric and Matt. Matt McKibben and Eric Alston, they were on the Bitcoin talk on a future city forum. I met them for dinner Sunday night before they left. And God, we stayed out till like 3 in the morning. We were having a good time. But it was such a great conference. It really was. And the conference was great, but I think the connections, too, that you make during it is just like, it's so enriching.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm so thankful. Thank you so much for having me as a co-host, as long as you want, because I think it's neat to have. I used to do this when I was in at Panasonic. We found that if you did my boss at the time when we were doing webinars and presenting to customers, he used to do them all himself. And then at one point he was training me to do the webinars by myself. And so we would have I'd listen in and I'd jump in and I'd comment, and we'd realize that when I kind of came in and I did part of the conversation and he did the other part, we were getting much better participation. People would ask more questions and they'd be much more engaged when we would do webinars with the two of us instead of just him. So I think the host-co-host format is really a cool thing. I just have to limit it down a bit.
Yeah. Well, the next one we're going to co-write.
I apologize for that, by the way.
No. This, to me, it was much less stressful to be, we got time crunch. Then I'm at the end of my material, and it's only 25 minutes into the show. To me, that's much more stressful.
What else can I talk about?
So sometime later this week, we've got 2 weeks to write the show, but it's basically for the voice and exit review is basically a blank canvas to work with.
Yeah.
And I'm only going to ask a couple of things before we call it a night. One is, if there's anything you talked about want to share links and, you know, for more information type stuff, forward it to me and I'll put it into a mailing that I send out. And I'm going to start the habit of doing after every show for more information mailing. So if you got it, you mentioned a couple of things and I didn't jot them down, but you know, fire that off and I'll include it. And the second thing
if it's okay with you, I'll probably send a link to Fluence's website. I'll send a link to my LinkedIn. And there's a couple of permaculture sites that I like. And maybe something on what makes sense.
The mailing I'm going to do is going to be topical to what we talked about tonight. And but go ahead and send your – actually, I've got your LinkedIn. But at some point, I think what I want to do is add our bios maybe to the welcome email, or do a second maybe do a follow-up email, about your hosts for people who are new to the show or new to the mailing list. So
okay.
I think that's more appropriate, but that's just an idea I just had. And you said you're going to Vegas. So when would be a good time for us to maybe put aside an hour to start talking about the show?
I would say either Friday or Saturday, maybe, if that's okay with you this week.
Yeah, Friday's a better time.
Okay.
I don't know what I'm going to be doing Saturday.
Yeah, let's do Friday after, evening then, if that's okay.
Sounds good. Friday evening's the plan.
Besides me, just ranting a little bit, I would appreciate do you have any critiques for me? Please stay in this context. Or actually, what might be better, like you're saying, if we write it together, then I can kind of bullet out the topics I want to touch on. And then if we say, let's keep this segment to, 10 minutes. Let's keep this segment to, 15 minutes, because I'm sure Max will appreciate that, too, for the next one. So what do you think?
I don't have any critique at this point because I pretty much threw you to the wolves. it's like... Hey, come on in and co-host. And before this afternoon, you had no idea what we were going to talk about. So you did really great for pretty much ad-libbing. So
I tried. I stressed out for a bit. When I came home, I was like, fuck, what am I going to talk about? But actually, yeah, a lot of it came to me. There was a few things that I looked up. I didn't know. I knew I wanted to talk about how many people there were in the world, and then I Googled it, and I was like, 9 billion people by 2050, what the hell?
Yep.
And then yours even said it was 9 billion by 2035.
It may have been 2050, because I don't specifically remember, but the real point of the whole book is how are we going to prepare to provide abundance for 9 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole book, which is about 400 pages, is effectively a roadmap on how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool.
I
have to read it then. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. Funny. My reading list from came specifically from Voice and Exit. Too many speakers quoted Buckminster Fuller, and I realized, I've never read anything completely. I've just soundbited him. Yeah, I've soundbited him, but I've never read anything, at length.
I was the same way. I was like, shoot, everybody's talking about Bucky Fuller. I need to get this, what was his main book? I wrote it down. I forget. But I when I was younger, when I was 16 or 17, I read, what is it, On Walden Pond, right?
That's Thoreau, right?
Yeah, by Henry David. H.G. Thoreau. Ow, Luigi, damn it. My cat has razor claws right now, and she's messing with my foot. Hey, kitty, kitty. So, yeah, I definitely need to get that book.
So just this kind of confuses me. Now, you're married, right?
No, I'm not. Good. I'm glad it's confusing because I kind of meant it to be. When I got divorced about 3 years ago, and I kept my Walsh Wilder last name because it's really Walsh. I should have changed it back to just Walsh, but I go by Wilder. Or Walsh Wilder in the business world now because it keeps the creepos away,
Okay. So I will continue. I'll continue to introduce you as Corinne Walsh Wilder. So.
Okay. That works. That works.
That's how we do it.
Thank you. It's just one of those things that I actually, the real thing is I'm too lazy to go
get it changed. There's so much paperwork that you have to go through, and I'd have to change my passport, I'd have to change up my credit cards, and it's just a pain in the ass. So.
I was going to say, insert rant about unfair to women here.
Yeah.
So, I have just a couple of last thoughts. Obviously, we heard a lot about Fibonacci over the weekend. And mm-hmm. if we want to follow, before I had the whole, the whole Fibonacci conversation, I was planning to do 30 shows in the upcoming year.
Yeah.
Now, so if we go with Fibonacci, here's
Hey, Cliff, Colleen just walked in from a show. You can say hey.
Hi, Cliff.
Hi, Colleen. How you doing?
I'm great. Good to hear from you again.
Hey, glad you're on speaker where you can hear us yak.
Yeah.
Yay. Fun for me.
So if actually, I think if we did anything wrong tonight, we went too long on the empathy segment. But mm-hmm. the idea I had to meet the whole Fibonacci idea is the Fibonacci numbers are 21 and 34.
Mm-hmm.
So my thinking is 21 full shows, sort of like we just did, and then maybe 34 empathy segments, which are intended to be standalone 5-10 minute bits. And when we start doing as I figure out the true syndication and podcasting thing, I think that'll be more valuable. And on top of that, we could pre-record the empathy segments and just release them basically on weeks when there's no show. And that there'd be like a 3 or 4 week overlap. What do you think about
that
idea?
I like that a lot, actually, because I'd rather on the shows, I saw your email on that, and I kind of thought about it for a minute, and I was like, well, you don't want to go too long without a show, but at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, it's one of those things where you want much rather have quality over quantity, right? And if you do the empathy segments like you're saying, I think that's great. You can do one in each show, maybe two if you want, but I like the idea of pre-recording because the empathy piece is, or it could even be not necessarily just us all the time, too. It could be other little people that you interview that could be an empathy segment. But I think that's one thing that I felt bad about and I was wondering if you were going to bring up is during your empathy segment, which I didn't really empathize and think about it when I was talking, but I should have been more hopeful if it's an empathy segment.
Yeah.
I can't remember what I said exactly, but, you know me, and I appreciate, I don't think you actually told me before now that you really meant for me to be the co-host because I had a little bit of a differing view from you. That's the first time I heard it, which is
no,
insane.
I didn't. I don't think I did tell you that it was a yin yang. I expected it to be a yin yang relationship. I had this in the course of meditation. It came to me that abundance and meditation are yin. I'm sorry, abundance and sustainability are yin yang, and peace and health are yin yang. So I don't know exactly what that's going to translate to. I've lined up several people in the alternative health industry for the winter,
mm-hmm.
but that's as far as I've gotten.
Very
actually,
cool.
I've got two people. One is a somatic healer, and one is a kinesiologist. Did you meet Dr. K, Kieran Kirkendall? He was at Voice and Exit.
Kirkendall. I didn't think he did.
He didn't speak. He was in the audience.
Uh-huh.
And he happened whenever we were Kieran. He's a really cool guy. He basically is trained as he's a chiropractor, and then he trained as a kinesiologist, and then he decided he wanted to really really help the world, So he paid off all of his medical or his student loans, and now he basically wanders the earth healing people in the third world. Kind of like a healer version of Kwai Chan Kane, if you're old enough, if you've ever watched the old Kung Fu series.
Yeah.
He kind of does that.
I've heard of it.
He kind of does that as a healer. He's a really cool guy, and I've known him for 2 or 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been at both of the Voice and Exits I've been to.
Hey, so why did you decide this year to go to the conference instead of volunteer, may I ask?
Well, the conference was so cool that I actually paid for it before the last. They had a deal of half price if you paid for it before the end of the last conference was out.
Mm-hmm.
So I had my ticket before the closing meditation of the, I bought my ticket for this year on Sunday of last year.
Awesome.
So you've been
looking forward to this for a while.
For a year and a half, because they were slow to get it out. It was in summer last year, but mm-hmm. plus the thing was that the volunteer work is very different this year than it was last year. They had a group of just 15 or 20 people, and each of us actually had a shift on something, but we were expected mm-hmm. to help out throughout the whole conference. There were probably 6 or 8 people that actually did that, but most of them just did a shift somewhere, and then they were free to roam the conference the rest of the time. And
yeah.
I missed quite a few of the seeds talks, and I also worked the door for the part for Bloom, so I didn't actually get to do. I didn't actually. Last year at Bloom, they had fire spinners, and I missed them totally. It was really crazy because they had to have a fire marshal on site and turn the fire, you know, the fire suppression stuff completely off while the fire spinners were doing their thing,
mm-hmm.
and. To do that legally, they had to have a fire marshal on site during the show.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty crazy. I only had two criticisms of this year over last year. One is last year they fed us lunch both days, Saturday and Sunday.
I'm sorry. I would have thought for like a pretty much $400 ticket that we would have got meals.
Yeah.
I think it was fine that, like, I didn't have a problem going out and buying food because, like, what is, like, lunch and dinner, big deal, 10, 15 bucks. But, like, and it was kind of nice to be able to, like, get out and away and, like, come back. But I was not expecting that.
Yeah. Well, it was only lunch last year, but they did provide lunch both days. And the second thing was, I don't think they did a good job of letting us know that the Sunday events were not at Fair Market. So I showed up at Fair Market, and then the Harvest was at the Handsome part, you know, where at Handsome, like the block away.
Mm-hmm.
But almost no one was showing up at Handsome because everybody wanted to go to the Future Cities Forum. And I had to find a ride, and that's why I was an hour late to it. I was on time, but it was an hour before I got to the power plant because I didn't know that the Future City Forum was at the power plant.
Mm.
So,
yeah, the only reason I knew is because I downloaded the app. I think did you get the app?
No, I was just linking into the web page. And
that's the only reason I was, like, successful about this. But you know what? I think they really should have given some sort of, like, program or booklet or something.
Well, I think that was the solution to a problem from last year of they printed programs, but it had mm-hmm. there had been so many last-minute changes that it was wrong. So they didn't want to put it in print, and I could see that. But on the website, to get to the to where it talked about the locations, it was several the locations was several layers deep. They should have taught just in the base schedule. They should have shown where the locations were, as opposed to a link off of a link off of the schedule. But certainly, I won't be talking to Max about that on air. Might be on the side, but not on air.
Yeah, I definitely think Max needs talking to you. But I'll do that on a comments board or something. Yay!
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, you got your sister there. You're probably wanting to hang out, and it's 9:30, and I have a 7 a.m. call.
Oh, my. I have a 5:55 a.m. flight to Vegas. So, yes.
I spent 18 actually this is my second stint as a traveling consultant, and that's what made me quit the first time, was having to get on planes at 5 a.m. on Monday morning. In this gig, I fly out on Sunday night, and I get there in time for a late supper, drive in, and go to bed. And I'm not trying to get my 40, because I'm a consultant. You have to do your billables. I didn't get my 40. You had to get your 40 billables in, losing half a day, you know, two half days of the work week to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, no way, no. So anyway, I am going to call it a night, and we'll talk on Friday.
Okay. Let me know what's good for you on Friday. Probably around, I don't know, maybe around this time again, like 8-ish.
Probably, yeah, maybe a little bit earlier. 7:30. And we'll firm it up. Have a safe trip. And thanks. And you know, you'll be able to listen to yourself. That same link I sent you will actually be the recording in about, by now.
Ew. Oh, really? I have to listen to myself talk?
You can. You don't have to.
Okay. No.
Yeah, I'm sure you hate listening to yourself talk.
Everybody hates listening to themselves talk, but I especially hate listening to myself talk.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll talk to you later.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again. Bye.
I enjoyed it. Bye.